Tonight on Arena, King of the Cruise, Perfumes and You've Been Trumped Too are the movies up for review, and fashion designer turned author Douglas Stewart on his debut novel, Shuggy Bane. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, the confusion around and then the messaging from the government around access to arts venues has been disappointing, to say the least. At least now we know that businesses and services like museums, cinemas, theatre and art galleries are deemed controlled environments and so can continue to operate where appropriate physical distancing and other measures are in place, with an overall maximum attendance of 50 people. However, all other indoor cultural events are subject to the 6-person maximum rule, and outdoor events subject to the new limit of 15. So those who had been planning to move outdoors will now have to take that new reality on board, and I'm sure we'll be following what happens there in the coming days and weeks. But cinemas do come under the controlled environment rule, so that's where we begin tonight. 3 films up for review. King of the Cruise, about a man who spends his free time on the ocean waves. Perfumes, about a single dad's friendship with a perfume nose. And the film The Trump Empire Tried to Suppress, You've Been Trumped Too, a sequel to You've Been Trumped. And this is the story of Donald Trump's plans to build a golf course in Scotland. Chris Wasser and Arlene Hunt are reviewers, and they're with me. Well, Chris is with me in studio, and Arlene joins me on the line this evening as we're obeying social distancing rules. We begin with the documentary King of the Cruise, a biographical story of a man. I don't know if I've ever come across a man like Ronnie Ressinger before. Arlene, who is Ronnie? He's a baron, and he tells us that several times, but tell us more about him.
He certainly is a baron. He's a Scottish baron. He's actually born in New York, but he's a Scottish baron of Inverurn. And his full name would be, well, his full name is too long for me to go into here, but basically he's Baron Ronald Bush Risinger of Inverurn. And that is sort of only partially what he would say when he introduces himself to people on his cruise, his various cruises that he takes. He's a much larger than life character in every way, shape and form. He's a huge man. He was 6'3". He said he's reduced back down to 6 foot tall at the moment. Big in every way, big in personality, big in stature. He's a hugely, hugely, hugely man. He's quite morbidly obese. And he basically spends all his time going around on luxury cruise ships. That's what he does, that he spends as much time as he can on a luxury cruise ship.
Because he has the money to do it, I guess. Chris, do we follow him on one cruise in this documentary, or do you see him on a number of cruises?
As far as I can recall, that's an interesting question. Now, I think it was just the one cruise.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Yeah, but he does spend all of his time on luxury cruise ships, but he chooses to do it alone. Now, he's been married twice. His first marriage, as he tells us, ended in heartbreak for him, at least. I mean, there is one point in moment where he says that he just did not see the breakdown of his first marriage going. And then next of all, he tells us that his wife, who is a lot younger than he is and who we never actually see, he is well aware of the fact his friend told him that she married him for his money. I think at one stage this guy was a broker. He is actually something of a king in Senegal, but he is a baron, and he spends all of his time, if he's not wearing a cape to remind those on board that he is royalty of sorts, he literally shuffles up to strangers and introduces himself, hands out his cards, and reminds them when they address him as Mr. Ronald or Mr. Ressinger, no, I'm a baron, and I'm here to tell you why I'm the most interesting character on this ship. Yeah. And that's how he likes to spend his holidays.
Did we say he's a baron, yeah?
I think, yeah, he's definitely a baron, isn't he?
Yeah. Every chance he gets, he tells us, I'm a baron. So here he is, after he's told us he's a baron yet again, telling us about what that meant for him as a child.
I was born with not a silver spoon in my mouth. I was born with a gold spoon in my mouth. I had everything handed to me. I didn't have to do anything, didn't have to worry about anything. Bills were always paid for, doctors were always available. We had chauffeurs and nannies and maids and cooks. And I mean, that was just part of life.
Not an ounce of irony to be heard anywhere in the voice of Baron Ronnie Ressinger there. We should be clear that he is a baron. He is an extraordinary character and has he just doesn't care about telling you how wealthy he is and how he can afford to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, with whomsoever he wants, Chris.
That's the thing. He creates a very bad first impression with some people because, as I said, he shuffles up to strangers. And if he notices, mostly couples, so if he notices that one part of the couple, if he notices that maybe the husband or the partner isn't listening, he'll call them out. I'm not listening, because he says, you know, I have interesting stories. You should be paying 100% of my, you know, attention here. But the thing with him is that he is this rich character. He is larger than life. He's well aware that he, you know, he is literally eating himself to death. I mean, his meal orders are quite extraordinary. But this film isn't judgmental. Instead, it's kind of shining a light on how, you know, the 1% live. And also, in a way, shining a light on a man who, despite his, you know, immediate arrogance, despite the fact that he is quite quirky and people are a little bit awkward about being stuck around him, I thought he comes across as desperately sad and he's seeking validation. And I think a lot of that goes back to the fact, and he mentions at one stage, his mother abandoned him when he was a baby. So there's an awful lot going on there.
Sophie Dross is the director here. I presume that's how I say her name, Arlene. And I guess that's what you find yourself eventually being pulled in by, not the arrogance of this man, but when the cracks begin to appear. And I guess that's down to her and her direction and how patient she must have been with him.
Yeah, he's allowed a lot of leeway. He's a very, very lonely man. I mean, there is no ifs and buts. Like as Chris mentioned earlier on, you know, that he chooses to go on cruises alone, but I don't know if he chooses to go alone or not, or whether his immediate family just don't want to spend any time with him. She's filmed all him on the periphery of a lot of action, which I thought was really interesting. You know, he's always watching things. And this is a cruise, so it's full to the brim with loved up middle-aged couples dancing, going to discos and going for their meals together. And he has nobody. And that's the thing about him. He keeps going to engage with people and to try and find a way, a route in to, you know, to have company and to talk to people. The unfortunate thing about Ronnie is he doesn't seem to understand how to speak to people. You know, he doesn't seem to understand how to connect with people. So his default position is just to kind of go, well, the most and he does say at one point in this, you know, the most interesting thing about him is that he is a baron. That's his default shield, you know. So he throws it out there like he's throwing out a fishing line, hoping to hook somebody of interest and someone will have a chat with him. And you know, and he's aware of the fact that people might take advantage of him. He's aware of the that his second wife, you know, like as Chris said, took advantage of the fact that he's wealthy. And as he said himself, well, why wouldn't she? She's smart. I mean, he's a lonely gentleman of a certain age who, as he said himself throughout the documentary, the older he gets, people aren't interested in old people. Their eyes glaze over when they see him. He's not physically imposing anymore. This is a man who's losing everything around him, so he desperately wants to make a human connection.
Yeah, and as you say, we get these sequences where he's talking to other people and you think, really, socially, he doesn't quite know how conversation works when it starts with, I'm a baron and do you know what a baron does? Almost every conversation. But here's when he's talking just to himself to the camera, we do begin to see maybe where the cracks are. And here he is talking about his first marriage.
The first time I really had my heart broken was when my first wife left me. She and I had had a very difficult, very, very difficult marriage. But I loved her so deeply. I just wholeheartedly just adored her. And she came, we were on vacation in Florida with the kids. They were 6 and 4, 7 and 5, something like that. And in Florida, the hotel, and she came and she said, I want a divorce. I said, what? What? You want a divorce? What? I know, not an inkling she wanted a divorce. Now, I had an inkling that we had trouble in our marriage because we did have trouble, but absolutely no idea. And she broke my heart.
See, and suddenly you do feel sorry for Baron Ronnie Reisinger when he tells us that, and the other aspects that he talks about that Chris touched on. We don't hear it there, you know, that beautiful piano music that's playing underneath him, but that bursts out from that into the smulchiest, cheesiest lounge music that you could ever think of. Real elevator cruise music. The music is worth mentioning in this one, I think, Arlene.
Oh, it definitely is. Oh, God help us. It puts years on you. It really does. I'm not much of a crooner anyway at the best of times, but this is sort of pared back croony music. And it's, I just found it insufferable, to be perfectly, perfectly honest. But then there's a lot of things in this cruise ship malarkey that I found insufferable. I found the whole cheery Disney-esque behavior of the staff to be really particularly disturbing. Oh, yeah. I found the activities that people were going. I mean, there's a wonderful shot in the disco, which downstairs, and all the sort of, it's a sea of khaki and white. They're all dancing around, and you can. There's a lovely pan shot of one of the instructors, who's this gorgeous, handsome, either South African or Australian young, one of the young staff members, and you can almost see the moment where his heart just stops working, you know, because this is his life now. And then the camera pans up, away from all the dancing, fleshy, middle-aged, which I am, by the way, middle-aged, so I'm okay with this, saying this, but away from them, to a line of children up in the rafters, who are watching this with their heads tucked into their chins, bored out of their mind. And they can't believe what they're seeing below them. It's just like, I thought, imagine being trapped in that situation. And imagine being trapped on this ship with these people.
Well, you're probably quite happy then that social distancing would not allow you go on any kind of cruise at the moment. Did this documentary give you any desire to be on a cruise, or was it really just finding out about this man? Is that what it ultimately is about? The cruise is kind of by the way.
Yeah, it was finding out about this man, but I think it did solidify something that I had always suspected about myself, which is that I never ever want to go on one of these luxury cruises. But also, there is a wonderful shot halfway through this film where Sophie Dross lifts up from the cruise and shows you the entirety of the ship, and you've got thousands of people in their rooms, swimming, running, like a lot of people going for a run. And I think what that was telling us was, what that was telling me was, I never want to do that, but also that look at Ronald down there trying to connect with one of these people, and it's just not working out for him. So what I actually think it is it's a fabulous little film about people watching. Because you're seeing it from the perspective of the kids, from Ronald, from the people who work there, from everybody on board.
Stars from you, first of all, Chris.
Well, I say it's a fabulous little film about people watching, but there are some flaws here. It clocks in just over 70 minutes. It's fascinating. You know, it's probably not, you know, essential viewing, but we'll go with three.
Three from you. What are you saying, Arlene?
Oh, I gave it 3 out of 5, too. I really enjoyed delving into Ronnie a little bit more as the documentary went on, but you know, there was an awful lot of clips that I could have done without as well, and it does drag a bit in places, so it was a solid 3 out of 5 for me.
And did you know him any better at the end of, did you know Ronald any more better at the end of the movie?
I felt sorry for him, and right, that's a weird thing to say for a man of his wealth, you know, that I felt genuinely sorry for him.
Right, let's move on then to film number 2, Lovers of the Netflix series Call My Agent, which follows the ups and downs of an actor's agency in Paris. We'll be interested in the fact that Gregory Montel, who plays Gabriel, stars in our next film, Perfumes, or Les Parfums in the French, the original, directed by another Gregory, in fact, Gregory Magne. Montel here in Perfumes, it plays a character called Guillaume Favel. Tell us a little bit about this. If you can say it, out of luck, that's an understatement of the century, I think, Chris.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said his name first. I was worried about mispronouncing that. Guillaume, who is, he's in a bit of a rush, and he is recently...
Guillaume, like William.
So Gregory Montel's character is recently divorced. We're not entirely sure why he is a father, but we kind of guess that, you know, he's not the most reliable man in the world, and he's struggling to hold down a job even, and he needs to grow up. So he's barely holding on to his job as a chauffeur. He's got too many points on his license. Even his jerk boss is kind of thinking, you know, look, you're on your last straw here. One day on a job, he is sent to pick up Mademoiselle Anne Wahlberg, played by Emmanuel DeVos, and she is a perfumer. She is what they call a nose, and she used to be a world-renowned perfume designer, but she's actually working at, you know, designing now nice smells for stinky brands and for factories. That's her job now.
Yeah, if there's pollution coming from a factory, she's supposed to go there, smell, and say, what do I need to add to the air that's coming out of the factory to make sure that the local residents aren't going to complain?
That's it, and one, and also to make... maybe stinky leathery bags smell a bit better with her perfume designs. And she's a bit all over the place, which we'll learn more about as the film goes on. And they strike up this unlikely and at times quirky friendship. You know, this is not really a romance. It's more about the two of them helping one another out.
Her personality is extraordinary, actually. The character here, the nose, le nez, as we might refer to her, Arlene, you wouldn't want to spend too long with her, but yet you end up, I ended up kind of liking her.
I liked her, but she's a bossy, She's an isolationist. Like at one point, her agent says, you know, she'd be much happier if she was just left alone in her apartment with her perfumes and didn't have to have any kind of human interaction. And that's quite true of her. She does not suffer fools at all. She has a very short fuse when it comes to like her, even with her own agent. But she's very true to herself. And I really like that about her. But she's a bit bossy and a bit much. And when they meet in Italy, like one of the first things she does is she throws his packet of cigarettes out of the passenger seat of the car. And he's so affronted by this, you know. But she, her argument is, and it's becomes quite clear as it goes along, she can't have the smell of smoke around her because it affects her senses. And, you know, it's quite cute. And very, very quickly, he's suddenly on the e-cigarettes really quickly. So he doesn't offend her. But she's very prickly. She's very... But she knows who she is the whole way through the film. Like she doesn't make any apology for what she is. Like she understands the gift that she has. She nurtures the gift that she has up until a point, and so she expects people to sort of bend their way around her. She's the immovable force.
Please and thank you, or even s'il vous plaît or merci. They are not words in her vocabulary. She has a lot to learn in that score.
No, and that's the only thing he asks of her at one stage. Well, she asks an awful lot of him, you know, to change the sheets in the hotels when
she
they arrive.
Really ask. She
well,
tells.
She demands him to change sheets and to, you know, give up the cigarettes and all the rest of it. And all he asks of her at the beginning is to learn to say please and thank you. But then he becomes much more helpful in her profession. He becomes something of an assistant. And again, like something I touched on earlier, I kept expecting, I don't want to spoil anything, but for a film with romantic tendencies, it is quite interesting that it's more about their friendship. And you are guessing right up until the end, you know, is this going to develop into something more, maybe, you know, professional partnership? But the two of them are wonderful together. Where they create I think the two actors who portray them, Emmanuel DeVos and Gregory Montel, they create magic where the screenplay doesn't. And what I mean by that is sometimes this film leans into comedic territory and then pulls back. It leans into dramatic territory, then pulls back. And it seems a bit unsure of where it should land and where it's most comfortable. But I think the performers are they're in key. They know what they're at. Mm. And Emmanuel DeVos, both the character that she plays and also that actress, I would watch her all day. I thought she was the most valuable player here. She is just brilliant at being the prickly character, at being the one who doesn't want anyone around her to do anything that she hasn't told them to do, but also slowly throughout the film learning to adjust. I thought she was fabulous.
The only thing I thought of this was, and I know we're living in practically a virtual world at the moment, I wanted to be smelling what they were smelling every time.
Because you want scratch and sniff film.
I want scratch and sniff film, absolutely. I wanted that I was sent a series of little sticks with the film and that I was told smell this at 4 minutes, 55 seconds. Because they start describing these aromas and you're dying to, well, I was dying to experience the aroma. Were you with me? Anybody? Arlene, please.
I don't want to know what the smell of sulfur is like. Rotten eggs.
Yeah, okay, I didn't want that one.
She gives quite a few brilliant descriptions of compounds that are sort of less something I'd like to smell. it's great. Like she breaks down the compounds for Chanel. She breaks down the compounds for Dior. Mm. There's a wonderful scene in the cinema where, again, we're coming back to the saying please and thank you to and noticing people and noticing waitresses, where she's very dismissive of a perfume that the waitress is wearing. And she's quite condescending about it. You know, it's an unimaginative perfume for unimaginative people. And then he just looks at her and goes, yes, I used to buy it for my wife. I just thought it was like, ow. And but then she doesn't even apologize for that. She just goes, désolé. But it reached, you can tell she does not mean it one iota. So there's like, it's really powerful, all these ideas. And she talks about the emotion of smells. And but even that is so much fun because at one point Guillermo talks about, like, you know, the emotional connection he has to the smell of mown grass, which a lot of people have.
Yeah.
And she completely, I'm not going to give it away, but she completely destroys his romantic idea of the smell of cut grass is. And it was really fun to watch this kind of interplay between the two main characters and how, you know, he would go off on this sort of meandering romantic moment and then she would just completely cut it down to size, you know.
Yeah, because she has a memory related to a smell as well. And I thought at one point, oh, we're going to go down a big nostalgia route here in terms of the smells of childhood or the smells of whatever it might be that bring back memories to people. And I thought we were going that way at one point, but we don't, which says a lot about it as well, Chris.
Yeah, we don't. And I think there are a few problems with Gregory Magnay's screenplay. I found even towards the end, again, not giving anything away, but there was a sense I found that he wasn't really sure how to wrap up his story. And there are a few third acts, not twists, but there are a few things that happened that just came out of nowhere. So that's a bit disappointing. But as I said, performances. And also, I think this might be my final week as a film critic because I actually do want to become a nose. It looks like such a fun job.
Stars from you, Arlene.
Oh, I gave it 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. It took me to little places I wasn't expecting to go, and I love when that happens in a film.
And Chris?
I'd have agreed with Arlene if the third act had been stronger, but I thought it was pleasant, agreeable, and yeah, we'll go with a solid 3.
A solid 3 from you. Let's move on then, finally, to the documentary You've Been Trumped 2, and that's T-O-O, You've Been Trumped 2. Tells the story of an Aberdeenshire mother and son, Molly and Michael Forbes, experience the wrong end of the Trump empire's expansion plans. This is Anthony Baxter's follow-up to a 2012 documentary, You've Been Trumped, which was all about... Tell us what that film was about, first of all, Chris, before we get into this one.
Yeah, that first film was released in 2012, and it was about Donald Trump's plans at the time to build a luxury golf course on the coast of Aberdeen, which would essentially ruin the land there. And, you know, the protests that he came up against, and also the fact that he had promised at the time that it would create 1,000, maybe even more jobs. And, you know, 5 minutes in Donald Trump's company, you know, he doesn't know how to, you know, deliver on a promise. So that was what we were dealing with in the first piece. And Anthony Baxter then went away. I think he made a different film about it. And then he decided, look, I'm actually going to make a standard follow-up, and that's where we have You've Been Trumped 2.
Okay, and let's just get a little bit of what You've Been Trumped 2 touches on, which is on Michael and Molly and Michael Forbes. Who are they, Arlene, and what's the problem they're having?
Molly is in the film is a 92-year-old resident of Balmide, and her son is Michael Forbes, who lives in another house close by to hers. And they, Michael Forbes, when Donald Trump originally thought to create his his golf course there, he wanted to take over. He wanted to buy the land that Michael Forbes owned, but Michael Forbes was not for selling. And Donald Trump was very derogatory about him. He called him, you know, he said he was an animal and he was living in a pigsty, all these sorts of things. And Molly is Michael's mother.
Yeah.
Trump described Molly as reminding him.
Well, let's listen to him talk about his mother. Yeah. And we'll hear Molly's response to that, because it's touching on what you were about to say there, I think.
And I do it in honor of my mother. My mother was a great Scot. She was a very proud Scot. She was born in the Hebrides, and she was a tremendous woman, and she loved Scotland in Stornoway. She loved Scotland, and I think she'd be very proud of what I've done.
It just shows you he doesn't care for anything or anybody but himself. He is a child, never grown up. We about 5 years, just buying bottled water, all because of Trump, building the road over the spring.
So there we go. That's Molly Forbes there. And you also heard the voice of Donald Trump in You've Been Trumped 2, documentary from Anthony Baxter. Now, we should have seen this film around the time of the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States. Wasn't it around then?
That's it, yeah. I mean, there's an argument to make that this film is quite timely, but it's also quite dated in a way, because it just goes up onto the rallies before the 2016 presidential election. Long story short, Anthony Baxter, he made a bit of a splash with that first film. It was the only reason that Donald Trump actually agreed to be part of the sequel. But the Trump Organization, because he was shining a light in the fact that, look, Donald Trump left this 92-year-old woman without a water supply. She's been like this for 5 years. And because he kept it up, the Trump Organization tried to suppress the film, and he was faced with legal threats. He was arrested a bunch of times, and that's why we're only seeing it now.
Yeah, but and how problematic does that become? Because what Molly Forbes says there, he's a child, you know. Now, this distance into his presidency, that's something we've heard. That type of criticism is something we've heard quite a lot. If we had heard that from somebody like her at the time of the election, would it be a different film, Arlene?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, Trump has his base, and that's, as far as I can see, is almost an immovable base. I mean, there are a couple of scenes in this where Michael goes to the States, and he goes to the States around the times of the rally, and he talks to certain supporters. But I mean, a lot of the supporters that he spoke to, and he gave a description of what's happening, the realities of what's happening in Scotland, a lot of them were unmoved. You know, they would still consider him to be the pick. There was a couple of interesting scenes. He spoke at one point to a pastor called Vineyard, who clearly understands the type of man that Trump was, and he was an evangelical pastor. He was still going to vote for him, and he was still going to support him. So it's, you know, and I could see Michael's face, you know, during those scenes, you know, when you're faced with that kind of complicity. I mean, Michael's a very simple man. He isn't trying to be anything else. He's not trying to be a politician. He's just trying to live the quiet, simple life that he's always lived. And you can actually see the moment where he realizes the monstrosity that he's up against and the complicity behind it. And, it, you know, he looks so disheartened. It's hard not to feel sorry for him.
There's a scene quite early on where Donald Jr. refers to the little people.
Little people, yeah. How they've dealt with the little people. How they've dealt with the little people's problems. That really resonated with me, how he described them and how quickly he is to lie about things. And he has no objection to lying, Donald Trump. And then he's talking about conservation work in Africa, how, you know, he makes this big issue about how they donate their shoes afterwards, because if you're in Africa, if you're lucky enough to have one shoe, you're practically a king. I was thinking, what are you talking about? What are you actually talking about? And this is the mindset you're trying to deal with.
This is a David versus Goliath film. Does it hold you for the period? It's quite a short film.
Well, it is quite a short film. I'm clocking in at around 78 minutes. But to be honest, I felt it was, it felt longer.
It had been stretched.
I think it had been stretched, yeah. And I mean this in the best possible way, because, you know, you are dealing with a determined and very patient broadcaster and investigative journalist who's trying to make life better for Molly Forbes. But unfortunately, the film has an awful habit of, on one side, repeating itself far too much, and on the other, kind of just relying on the fact that maybe you saw the first one. You know, maybe he should have gone back and filled in a few blanks there. And it's a bit uneven in its tone as well. I mean, halfway through, we follow Michael Forbes to Washington, and it becomes a different film entirely. And actually, I might have preferred to have seen a bit more of that. And it's a little bit sloppily edited too when it starts to go down the route of examining Donald Jr.'s life and his career. So maybe it could have been pulled back, because at times I thought, you know, you could cut this down to 50 minutes and show it on television. But at the same time, it does what it's supposed to do, and it does make you angry, and it is quite powerful at times. I just don't think it needed to be that long.
Stars from you, Chris?
We'll go with 3.
You're going with 3. What are you saying overall, Arlene, and stars?
Overall, I don't know. I think there's a probably better film to be made, and I'd actually like Anthony Baxter to go after people like first former Minister of Scotland Alex Salmond, who allowed this to go ahead in the first place, because there was a huge uproar and furor before Trump ever, you know, turned the sod in Scotland. And there's a film there that would be very interesting to watch. But in regards to this film, it's fine in places, but like, I would agree with Chris on things. It's a bit sloppily edited and it's very repetitive after a while. And I started to lose interest in it. And I am interested, but I started to lose interest. So for me, it's just 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5 from you then. That's Arlene Hunt and Chris Wasser speaking to us this evening about, first of all, King of the Cruise, then Perfumes, or Le Parfum if you're looking for the French title, and finally the documentary You've Been Trumped Too. Recently nominated for this year's Booker Long List, Shuggy Bin is the debut novel of Douglas Stewart. It's the story of a boy growing up in Glasgow in the 1980s, struggling to find a way out of hard times for himself and his family. It's also the story of a boy's love for his mother, Agnes, who is lost in the haze of an alcohol addiction. Douglas Stewart joins me now from New York. Douglas, your background is very much in the world of fashion. You've designed for Calvin, for Gap, for Jack Spade. You know, there was a big creative career going on to the front of your life for a long time. Where was the writing, or when, or how long has the writing been happening?
Ah, Sean, that's a good question. Thanks for having me today. You know, I started writing Shuggy Bane about 12 years ago, sort of in secret and sort of for myself. You're right that I sort of worked in fashion, or I do work in fashion, but that wasn't necessarily my dream as a young man. You know, I grew up in Glasgow in the 80s and I'd wanted to actually go and pursue English and academia, but it was just never really seen as something like a boy like me should do. And so I was sort of diverted really helpfully into textiles and into textile manufacturing. And it's that that took me to New York and took me into a career in fashion quite unexpectedly, really. And so 12 years ago, I sat down to sort of get in touch with all these dreams that I'd furloughed for myself. And just over the past 12 years, sat down and wrote Shuggy. And that was really how the book came to be.
And we can hear that the Glasgow accent has never gone away.
No, how can you shake that?
You can't. And you don't even in the novel itself, you know, all of the dialogue, in fact, is written, you know, phonetically in that great Glasgow dialect. Did you know that? Well, of course, if you started 12 years ago, I suppose it was still very fresh for you then, was it?
Oh, definitely. But also living in New York, I go home 2 or 3 times a year. My family are still there. And so Scotland's always a big part life. But if you're going to write a book about Glasgow, one of the reasons to write a book about Glasgow is to use the dialect, because it's a beautiful tongue, and, you know, it's so wonderfully inventive. And that's part of, I hope, that's part of the charm of the book.
Of course, it certainly is. But so tell me this, just to divert slightly or just remain on that accent idea. When you go home, do they accuse you of speaking with an American accent?
They do, they do. And then when I'm in America, everybody says they don't understand.
Kind of make out, yeah. Welcome to the club of the Celtic accent. So listen, Shuggy Bain, again, until I started reading, I thought, is this a term? Does this mean something? Is this a Glasgow dialectical word that I don't, or dialectical phrase that I don't understand? It's simply a name.
It is, yeah. I mean, in Scotland, we often, especially the west coast of Scotland, when a man is called Hugh, we often just give him the nickname of Shug. And so Shuggy is really the nickname for young Hugh in the book. And Shuggy, like you said, is the main character. He is the youngest son of a woman who's sort of disintegrating, set against the backdrop of, you know, Thatcher's Glasgow in the 80s.
And Shuggy rhymes with Dougie.
Actually, I was never known as Dougie as a kid. I was always known as Douglas. So there's nothing to be drawn there.
All right. OK, so Douglas, it wasn't just Douglas when you were in trouble and Dougie at other times, no?
No, it wasn't. Actually, my dad was called, I never really knew my dad. My mom and dad split up when I was about 3. Mm. And so my dad was also called Douglas, but everyone called him Dougie. And my mother could never bring herself to call me anything shorter than Douglas, because I think it would conjure his memory.
Right. OK. Well, I mean, while it mightn't be, it's clearly not exactly your story that you're telling in Shuggy Bain, but you put Shuggy into the atmosphere that you grew up in. And there are several aspects of that atmosphere that are really worth talking about, I think, not least of which is the type of masculinity that Shuggy, and I presume you, encountered growing up in Glasgow.
Yeah, I mean, it is true. Shuggy Bain is a work of fiction, Sean, but I did grow up poor. I am the queer son of a single mother who lost her own battle with alcoholism when I was still in school. And so I draw on a lot of, Shuggy is fiction, but I do draw on a lot of my own experiences in the city and growing up in a really tough time in such a beautiful city. But one of the main themes of the book is sort of isolation for the characters. And as the character of Agnes becomes isolated through her addiction, Shuggy, the young boy from about the age of 6, becomes isolated because he's just not like the other boys. It's actually some adult characters that very quickly just define as no being right is the term in the book. And it doesn't go beyond that. It doesn't ever intellectualize itself. It doesn't wrap itself in religious belief. It's just you are not as how other boys should be.
And if Shuggy then is this character who finds himself in this very, it was toxic masculinity in the 1980s before we knew what that term even was, or probably what that term meant. How difficult was it for him to even let himself come above the parapet? And I mean, I guess I'm asking you this question about yourself as much as I am about him.
Oh, I think it's impossible to come up above the parapet, but then it's also impossible to hide who you truly are when there are such narrow ways for men to sort of be. Mm. And part of the reason why I wanted to, you know, and that's a thing that society imposes on itself at the time, you know. But, you know, there's part of the reason why I wanted to write Shuggy Bain is because there's some really great monumental works of fiction on the west coast of Scotland that focuses on a post-industrial landscape that looks at men as the heroes of it. But I'd never really sort of seen so much written from a mother's point of view or from the sort of the queer son of that mother. And we all know that when men start to struggle, it's women and children that suffer first. And so I wanted just to sort of like add to that sort of lexicon, I guess, where I sort of added to the tapestry of that from a queer boy's point of view and also his struggling mother.
Another aspect of the book that is very notable is the sectarian divide, the Protestant-Catholic divide. Where does Shuggy fit into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Shuggy sort of falls in the center, especially in America. You know, everyone was quite surprised that this is a thing that Glasgow has, but you will know that Glasgow has the second largest sort of Orange March after Belfast. Mm. And of course, we have a lot of sort of Irish immigration in the city, which has added to the city in a beautiful way. My own family actually come from Donegal. My mother's side come from Donegal, but my father's side are from the north of Scotland. And so growing up Sectarianism was always a part of my life. You know, my mother's family did not come to her wedding, to my father. And so sometimes it was a very casual thing, meaning it was just banter over the dinner table, you would say. I mean, we wouldn't say that today because it was always very hurtful. But back in the time, it felt like banter over the dinner table. And then at other times, it was how sort of gangs organized themselves on housing estates, which is funny in looking back because, you know, these are people who are identical, you know, both white, both poor, both struggling through the same things. And yet they still manage to find these sort of microscopic divisions amongst themselves. And so Shuggie sort of is, and actually I explore this a little bit in later books, I hope, but Shuggie is sort of just sort of whipped around by the winds of this.
He also, he finds himself then in the middle of the book, we're in Pithead, a part, an area called Pithead, and we're in the mines, we're in the mining world, we're in that particular social stratum, and Thatcher's Britain, because Scotland is part of Britain, and certainly was Thatcher was, Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister would have been having a huge effect on the mining industry in that part of the world. Why did you want to explore that particular aspect?
Well, first of all, because I grew up amongst it and I felt like it was worthy of the page and to show the struggle of people I love and to do that honestly. But, you know, Thatcher's policies ended up with about 14% unemployment across the UK, but it was about 26% in Glasgow and it stayed there for almost a generation. And we know that it's had knock-on effects with addiction, with health, with sort of the longevity of life, especially for men. And so I actually didn't set out to write a political book. I set out to write a very intimate book that just looked at this family who were doing the best they could to sort of, to hold together. But you can't really write a book about 1980s Glasgow, about a working class family without addressing politics. And so it was just, it was important to stare that in the face.
Let's go back to this idea that, you know, you said right at the early part of this, you've told me now that you're the queer son of a single mother and that the idea of moving towards, you know, studying English and academia was totally out of the question. The fashion world can hardly have been one that would have been easy to explain to the type of to people who might have been cocking their nose at the idea of you studying English.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, Sean, but, you know, my education, I think, was disrupted as a young boy so much by days I would miss trying to care for my mother, days I would miss because I was being bullied, and then also because so many of the kids in the environment were sort of coming to school not having their basic human needs met. So school was just a riot, I would say, and it was no fault of the kids or the people that were there, but it was just, it was a hard environment. And so to be able to like read a book, never mind write a book or follow that, takes an awful lot of peace within yourself, but also within the environment around you. And I just didn't have that. But what it was if I wasn't an academic kid and no one could imagine me going to a university to study English, I was a creative kid because that's all I had. I was a very lonely child, you know? And so I was all about making up imaginary worlds and drawing and sketching. And so textiles was seen as a very sort of practical application for a kid that needed a job because it was art-based, but what does Scotland manufacture other than, you know, more than whiskey and cloth? But even that was like a weird sort of twist that was affected by Thatcher, because when I started to study textiles, it was a booming industry in Scotland. But by the time I came out of college in the mid-90s, even that had been decimated and sent to the Far East. And so from there, I had to go on and sort of, I'm so lucky that I come from a country that supports education, even for its most deprived kids, because obviously by the time I'm in college, both my parents are dead, and so I was by myself. But Scotland allowed me to do a master's degree. I studied in fashion, and it's that, feeling a little bit untethered with no sort of family to hold me in Scotland, that took me to New York.
So then we're in New York, and you've got this, what seems on the surface to be, you know, a very creative career in the world of fashion. Was there something that was still scratching or itching at you that made you, was there some creative bone that wasn't being satisfied that meant you had to write?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually when I sat down to write Shuggie, I was at the apex of my fashion career. And to the outside, I think everyone would think it was going like incredibly well. But I still wasn't satisfied creatively. I think there's an intimacy to writing and a thing that you can do. And what I should tell you, Sean, is when I started to write the book, I never had intentions of it ever being published, nor did I have intentions or expectations that it would be read. You know, I think I was still internalizing an awful lot of inferiority. And so I sat down and wrote it for myself. And that's really the sort of the energy that took me through the book. And so it was sort of answering, it was making myself happy first. And the journey that's come from that has been just mind-blowing.
The fact that you were doing it and then in secret, if you like, then kept you away from, or did it keep you away from any type of reading course, any type of reading or writing group where you might share little bits and say, look, this is what I'm doing. What do you think? Was it totally secret? Was there anybody who knew what you were at?
It was totally secret. The first person and actually the only person to ever read it was my husband. And I think I'd been writing. He knew I was doing it because obviously we share a home. But I think it was about maybe 2 or 3 years before I let him read a couple of pages. And he, just sort of instantly within reading it, sort of looked at me and he said, oh, my God. And he said, you must keep going. And it was his encouragement that allowed me to keep going. But it was about 10 years before I let someone on the outside of my marriage read it.
Mm. But you're going or working in a creative world like you were working in, what kept you away from, say, a writer's group even? Even if you did say, look, I don't want to know what I want to do with this, or keep yourself as an anonymous person within all of that. What kept you away from that type of forum?
That was a deliberate choice, I think. I think, first of all, because I didn't want to take everything I do creatively in fashion. I should explain it this way. Everything I do creatively in fashion involves a team or involves feedback from people on the outside, whether it's the customer or whether it's the merchandiser. And so writing for me was an incredibly precious space where I could do it only for myself and then do it by myself. And so I actually sort of resisted feedback on the writing because the most important thing for me was actually spending time with my characters. I love them very deeply. And actually, I was a bit bereft when I finally couldn't touch the book anymore. And my editor was like, no, really, you have to let it go now. And I was a little bit bereft. And so I loved that sort of space. And I would go to work in the morning and I would sit and I would write on the subway. Sometimes if I was stranded in an airport, I was stuck in Hong Kong more times than I could count. I would write, I would ruin every single family holiday by just wanting to sit at a table, even when the sun was belting, and just write. And so for me, it was about sort of pleasing myself, I suppose.
And finally, then, the reaction when you heard the Booker Long listing.
Okay, it was unreal. You know, I honestly couldn't believe it. But then I had no expectations of the book. And I think as a writer, you can't. All you can really do is write the very best thing that you can in that moment. And so how people perceive it, how people receive it, even if it does get read or not, you can't control any of that. And so I'm just blown away by the Booker reaction.
Yeah, writing in secret now or writing openly? A second.
I am writing openly. I have some short stories that were just in the New Yorker, which has been fantastic, and I'm working on my follow-up.
Well, listen, congratulations on the debut and on that Booker Long listing. That's Douglas Stewart speaking to me about his novel Shuggy Bean, which is published by Picador. Netflix's new 6-part docuseries High Score offers a broad look at the 1970s origins of video games, from the basic Space Invaders up to the detailed role-playing games or RPGs of today. This series looks at an emerging medium and its growth into an interactive art form. Ciarán O'Brien is with me in studio this evening, having watched the series, and I had to find out the gaming credentials first of all. Ciarán, was the first thing I asked you. How big a gamer are you?
Well, I've been playing games since, I actually don't want to give the exact date because it will age me dramatically, but let's just say green screens were a thing, and so were disk drives, floppy disk drives.
Yeah. So you weren't there though for the original Space Invaders, because what I watched that first episode and it brought me right back in time to playing Space Invaders in arcades at college when I should have been at lectures.
Well, I know I wouldn't have been around for the original Space Invaders, but by the time I was getting interested in games, they had them on tabletops in a pub that we used to go to out in Docky, just outside. It's the Docky Island Hotel now. I think it's apartments now, but they used to have Space Invaders and Asteroids and a few others on these tabletop things. Now, I was probably only about 6 or 7 at the time, but we absolutely loved those machines. We lost a lot of money. We were not good at it. I was not good at it.
And that's what this series, particularly in the early section, it struck me. It looks at how what was kind of just an arcade game became, you say you lost a lot of money, it became a multi-million, billion pound and dollar industry.
It did. And the thing is, it could have gone the other way because there was this massive rush towards arcade machines and then Atari. And then there was a big bust. So that's basically what the first episode deals with, is that kind of boom bust era of gaming. So the idea that, you know, you could have these arcade machines. And I think it was when Space Invaders was launched, it actually caused a shortage of 100 yen coins because they would be what you were putting into them.
In Japan, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, they go into a little bit of detail. I think they probably could have gone into more. I mean, you could do a whole episode on Space Invaders by itself. But look, you know, this is a 6-part series. You can only go into so much detail. And they talked to the designer about how he came up with all these, all the aliens. And they showed his original drawings. And for the first time, I understood what those pixels were supposed to be. So, you know, he was talking about how the War of the Worlds inspired him. And they do all these I suppose, strange sequences where they superimpose, say, the graphics over real world scenarios. So you might see, like, you know, the little flowers from Mario at some point. But in this case, they were shown the War of the Worlds aliens. And then I understood why they were there and what they actually were.
Yeah, that Space Invaders designer, Tomohiro
Nishikado.
Nishikado. Yes. I mean, fascinating man. Loves magic. And that kind of, you got a sense from that, you know, where Space Invaders came from. But it also touches on those who play the games. And let's listen to a clip that features one of those. Rebecca Heinemann tells us about playing Space Invaders in the 1980s, at the birth, really, of the whole idea of that you could even have a contest playing Space Invaders.
It was the hottest game out there because it was one of the first games out there that had strategy. And as long as you can maintain that strategy, you could get a very, very high score. It was all about patterns. There's 6 rows of aliens. When you see the first one firing, then you have a good idea of who's going to be the next one firing. And then go ahead and slaughter them all. Those tricks you learn in order to get an edge. I'm Rebecca Ann Heinemann. My friends call me Becky, my enemies call me Rebecca. I got into the industry by playing in the Atari National Video Game Championship in 1980.
And we actually see that championship as part of the thing. We're talking about High Score, which is a Netflix series, 6-part docuseries on the history of video games. Ciara O'Brien with me in studio this evening. Rebecca Heinemann herself, it's an interesting story because she touches on this idea of how anonymous she could be playing back in the 1980s.
Yeah, that she could play as her true self because, you know, obviously over the years, you know, she went on to be a game developer herself, and she basically said she always, in her head, she was always a woman. She could play as a woman. And I think, you know, that's the overarching kind of thread throughout the whole series. I mean, later episodes touch on the creation of Madden NFL and how at the start there was no African-American representation in that at all. And at the time that was massively against how the actual sport was played. So, you know, the idea that you could play as your true self, you know, wasn't open to some people.
Yeah, she refers to herself. We see that on the back of a T-shirt at one point, Bill Heinemann, but she only ever refers to herself as Heinemann back in the 1980s.
She does, yes. Rebecca, and I think that's to be respected.
And that feeds into where the series, I think, goes later on in terms of RPGs or role-playing games. And you could literally create a role for yourself.
I remember playing kind of the early forerunners of those role-playing games, but obviously at a much later date. So I would have been kind of behind everybody. So at the start, like the games that you could play on a computer were text-based. This would have been sort of like after Atari kind of, you know, had its boom and then its bust with the E.T. fiasco, which was a game that was created in 5 weeks. So that's not altogether surprising.
And was a disaster. Everybody
Absolute
hated it.
Absolute disaster. Everybody hated it and they thought this is the end of video games. People actually, they took it off the shelves before Christmas, which was absolutely unheard of. And the whole point was they were rushing to get it out before Christmas. But, you know, those particular games machines weren't the be all and end all. The idea that you could play a game on a computer, you know, because computers were just they were business machines, you know, they were your workhorse. So the idea you could play a game on them was kind of something new. So it was Roberta Williams who, she got into playing this particular text-based game. It was some cave adventure game. The name escapes me at the moment, but she played it for about a month, got to the end and then thought, you know what, I can do this.
Yeah.
And designed her own game that later became Mystery House. So she sat and she designed the whole game, but she's not a games developer. So she drafted in her husband. And there's a great scene in it where she's talking about how she was going to get around him to do this because he was very busy. He'd set up a business and she wanted him involved in this. So she brought him out for dinner and she was smoozing him. And then she starts talking about murder and, you know, they're getting strange looks. She said, you know, she had him hooked. So he developed it and they came up with all these workarounds because obviously at the time the machines were far more limited than what we have now and the memory would have been far more limited. So you could only do certain things with it. So they found some workarounds and eventually came up with this game, Mystery House, and it took off.
Mm. And that whole role-playing, that RPG, is hugely important. I want to listen to a clip featuring Richard Garriott, who developed a game called Ultima, which is kind of the forerunner of all the RPG stuff. And let's just listen to what he has to say here.
Some of the ways that Ultima was quite unique back in the 1980s was that you would start through creating a character. Your character would have attributes like strength and dexterity and stamina, whatever it might be. It had characters and story. It had places where once you had gone out on a battle and fought that you could return to, a city or a town where you could replenish your supplies, rest up, heal up, those sorts of things. And so I sort of saw it as a world, a living, breathing fantasy universe to play as a player.
In an industry that had always assigned players a character to play, a game like Ultima allowed you to build one. It created an open world where you could then venture forth on epic quests and equip different weapons and armor to aid you on your adventure.
With Ultima, in a very real way, you know, I was finally beginning to flex a little bit of those game master roots.
Richard Garriott there speaking about the development of Ultima. Ciara O'Brien with me in studio this evening speaking about the Netflix docuseries High Score. We heard Charles Martinet, who's the voice of Mario himself. That gives he's narrating there at the end of the, or in the middle of that clip. That gives the series a kind of a kudos, I think.
It does. I mean, sometimes it can get a little bit in the way. You know, that there's a lot of very obvious tying together and, you know, kind of announcements, you know, the internet that I suppose people don't really need. But at the same time, yeah, I think it really does give it a bit of a cachet.
Does it address the controversy around violence in video games?
It does. In the later episodes, I think it's the fifth episode, you know, they've kind of made their way to Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat. And that was around early 1990s. And in 1993, there was a massive congressional hearing into the idea of games violence and how it was impacting the youth of today. And for that, I thought that was interesting because I don't remember this first time around. I would have only been about 12. This would have gone right past me. The idea that, you know, that they dragged out this kind of this little known game, Night Trap. It kind of has a cult status, but at the time, they probably wouldn't have played it. It was built originally for a Hasbro-backed game system that was dropped, and Sega picked it up and ran it. But it had some very weird things in it. It's definitely worth watching if you want to see how things can go wrong.
Final question. I've little interest in gaming, but I find myself hooked on episode one. Is this for a general audience or is it for, you know, somebody who's a big gaming fan?
I think it's kind of for both in that, you know, if you go into it with the expectations that this is a broad look at the games industry, it's not going to go into as much detail as games aficionados would like. But yes, I think anybody who has a vague interest in video games should watch it.
Ciara O'Brien speaking to us about High Score, which is available on Netflix now. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Pather Carney was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.